Yeah, my name is Gerd Zöller from University of Potsdam, and I'm interested in earthquakes, fault system simulation of faults and fault systems, and also on nonlinear dynamics and complexity, because I'm originally from a nonlinear dynamics group. And now I have to set up this. Yeah, okay, it seems to work.
You get one.
Oops. Yeah, so the title of my talk is Quasi-Dynamic Simulations of Long Deformation Histories on a Heterogeneous Fault. And this is a cooperation with Yehuda Ben-Zion, who is here, and with Sebastian Heinzel and Matthias Hohlschneider from the University of Potsdam. So Sebastian is in the geoscience department, and Matthias is a mathematician. So I have this keyboard. The goal of this work is to design conceptual fault models, that is, relatively simple fault models on the one hand, which allow to perform long simulations of deformation histories over about, or at least 1,000 years, and on the other hand, the model should be to some degree realistic. So that it's suitable, that this model can be tuned towards real fault systems to some degree, for example, the Park Field segment of the San Andreas fault. And in the framework of this fault model, we want to start different frequencies, different seismicity features. For example, frequency size distributions, the temporal occurrence of main shocks, and empirically known seismicity patterns like aftershocks and foreshocks, and also accelerating moment release. And finally, we can also look at the histories of single ruptures in terms of slip and stress. And this should be, or this will be studied as a function of the input parameters of the model. For example, frictional parameters or heterogeneities. There was a discussion yesterday whether these input parameters may be called tuning parameters or frictional parameters or roughness parameters. So if I talk of tuning parameters, I mean these are model parameters which can be tuned in the framework of the model, and they will be tuned, or they may be tuned, in order to simulate seismicity on certain known fault systems. Yeah, the basic assumption of the model is that we have a threshold dynamics for stress and strength. We have stress which increases until a certain material strength is reached on a geological timescale. Then we have a stress drop, a large earthquake occurs, and then the stress increase sets in again. This defines a seismic cycle. In this very simplified view, and this very simple model, which is in principle identical with Wright's elastic rebound theory. Oh, now I have the first problem. This is in principle Wright's elastic rebound theory, which is about 100 years old. The situation can be simulated by this very simple model here. This is a block which is moved over a rough surface by a driver plate with a constant velocity v. And this simple model leads to a stick-slip motion. We have first the block sticking on the surface. Then if the driving force equals a frictional force, we get a slip event, and then the block sticks again. And if these slip events are somehow considered as or considered to be earthquakes in this very simplified view. And in a mathematical expression, we can write down Newton's equation. Mx2 dot is k times vt minus x minus the frictional force, which depends on the block velocity. B is the velocity of the driver plate, and x is the position of the block. M is the mass. So this is a very simple model, and we can ask whether Let me first summarize the main features of this model. We have a periodic recurrence of events. If we define such a slip event as an earthquake, this is shown here, periodic occurrence of events. We have only one magnitude in this model. We get a periodic function for the stress and this simple staircase function for the slip. So this is, in principle, the simplest model of this class of conceptual models. And we can ask whether this is a suitable model for the Parkfield segment, for example, which is characterized by a relatively regular occurrence of large earthquakes in the last 150 years, with this exception here of the 1934 earthquake. And the next exception, as we all know, was the earthquake in 1980, or the earthquake which was expected in 1988 and came with a delay of 16 years last year. So even in the case of a fault segment with a relatively regular behavior of main shocks, such a simple model of a single block on a rough surface seems the vertical axis is in principle meaningless. It's the earthquake number. It's not really. It could be slip, but approximately. But it's only a sketch. It's in principle the earthquake number. Sorry, to this might be confusing. This simple model of a single block is apparently not suitable to model seismicity, even on such a segment like the Parkfield segment. So now I want to introduce the model which we use, or at least the model framework, which is based on the framework of Benzine and Rice, 1993. And on the next slides, I will also explain how we have extended this model. First, we consider a two-dimensional planar fold, which is embedded in a three-dimensional elastic half space, which is here, in this case, simply a Poissonian solid with a certain rigidity. The fold plane itself is divided into computational cells of uniform size. And the medium surrounding the fold moves with a constant plate velocity, which is in this case 35 millimeters per year. And this movement of the medium leads to a displacement on the fold, delta UKL. K and L denote the indices along strike and in depth. And this leads, of course, to a stress change on the computational cells, delta tau. And as we know, stress and displacement are connected by the Green's function, G, which is known here for this very simple case of a rectangular fold patch in an elastic half space. This is known from works of Chinnery and Okada. And a main feature of this Green's function in this case is that it decays here like 1 over delta R cube, as a function of the distance between source and receiver cell here. And a first step to make this to some degree realistic is we can introduce new boundary conditions. We can, for example, here introduce patches for earthquakes, for example, the 1906 and 1857 earthquake. And these patches are locked during the simulation, and they slip only once. The fact that they are locked during the our simulation leads to a reduction of stress on the fold plane. So this is the first step to tune it towards real fold systems. And now I come to the mechanisms which are included into the model. The first one has already been mentioned. We have a constant plate velocity, or a constant plate motion. U dot, the K state velocity is constant, and therefore the cells move independently of each other. So this is an uncoupled motion. The second one is we consider aseismic creep. Here we use a creep law from a work of Ben Sein in 1996, where U dot is proportional to the local stress to the power 3. So the important thing is that the cells are now coupled. We have to solve a system of ordinary differential equations here to calculate the creep velocity. And this will become important later. And finally, we consider the initiation of an earthquake itself. If the stress reaches the material strength, we get a stress drop. The large earthquake occurs, and we get also a strength drop from a static value tau s to a dynamic value tau d. This is the so-called static kinetic friction law here. And if this situation occurs, the stress becomes critical, and the stress drop occurs. Then we have a redistribution of stress to the other cells, and this is shown in the short movie. For an example, the earthquake is initiated here at the hypocenter, the green dot, and we have a propagation, a spatial-temporal propagation of stress over the entire fold. So the color here is the normalized stress field. Light color means that we have highly loaded cells, which are almost critical or which are critical, and dark color means that we have unloaded cells. And yeah, this corresponds to an earthquake, and this evolution of stress is terminated when all cells are again below the threshold. That is, they are uncritical. And as a new feature in comparison to other models, for example, to the Ben Sein and Rice 1993 model, is that we consider here really a propagation of stress, we consider a propagation of stress with a constant propagation or with a constant shear wave velocity, which is finite in this case. And this is in contrast to the so-called quasi-static models, where earthquakes usually occur instantaneously. So we have here a finite intra-event time scale, and therefore we call this type of model a quasi-dynamic model, although it is, of course, far away from dynamic rupture models. But it is slightly more realistic than the quasi-static models, where earthquakes occur instantaneously in zero time.
So, I'm sorry, just to make sure I understand. So you're using the fully relaxed Green's function. So that's the sense in which it's quasi, you're letting the stress completely equilibrate throughout the elastic cap space. Instantaneously, you have the frictional motion along the fault.
So how do you introduce the time?
It calculates the force on the interface points using the quasi-static elastic Green's function, and then propagates the
so in principle, no. We have here, we use the quasi-static Green's function multiplied with delta function in principle. So we, delta peak. And this.
Well, almost. Delta in what? Time?
Delta in time. Oh. So this gives a Green's functional. So the complete Green's function consists of this quasi-static Green's function times the delta function in time, and this gives a Green's function. Yes. So a single.
Tell a piece how much to move. You get stress, and that gives it a velocity. Is that right?
So the time where the if stress is transferred from this cell to this cell here, the time is given by the distance. So this is simply a constant velocity.
But how much does the material respond to that stress? Yeah, I thought I saw something before that you wrote down.
Yeah, so in any position there is a prescribed property, which in this case is associated with a stress ball.
Yeah.
And once you have, since once you get the stress ball, to get through the green function, you can calculate the C.
Okay, so in other words, I calculate to do an instantaneous stress calculation with the I took, okay, there's a delay.
There is a delay.
But when I know what the stress is at a particular point,
if the stress at that point is louder than the threshold, then there is a failure.
Yeah.
If there is a failure, there is a stress drop, and if there is a stress drop, you go back to the
new
function,
and
you calculate
the
stress. Okay. The
it's
probably
elastically.
Yeah.
The stress drops happen instantaneously, but shear waves are propagating the finite.
The stress drop occurs instantaneously here. For example, if the earthquake is initiated here, we have a stress drop here, and the stress is redistributed according to the quasi-static Green's function over the fold, but with a certain delay, depending on the distance between this point here and the receiver cell. And all these single stress transfer events occur, of course, instantaneously, but with this delay. And then if then we have a new stress field here on the fold. And as Yehuda said, if the if the receiver cell becomes critical, that is, the receiver cell is above the threshold, then it begins to slip and redistribute stress again, and so on until all cells are below the threshold. If
there's no friction or dissipative mechanism in here somewhere.
Yes. I mean, we prescribe the static and dynamic friction on the fold.
Yeah.
And that's the friction. So you know what stress it is. And then we use the Green function to calculate the slip.
Okay.
Given that stress.
If you're above threshold, then you drop the stress and you also drop the friction.
Yes.
Exactly. But are you using just
static dynamic?
Static dynamic.
Okay. Mm. It's either static or sliding.
So asking that a slip is propagated, it appears from the image that the header, what was previously very heterogeneous, is now quite homogeneous looking. Is that just because of the color scale we're looking at, or is it a
slip? No, this is the fold becomes really unloaded, so we have here a highly loaded fold. Just before the earthquake, this is typical for relatively smooth folds, that we have here these patches with highly loaded boundaries, and then we have these patches are ruptured almost in series until the fold is almost unloaded, because we have some kind of dissipation, or it's not really dissipation, because stress is goes over the boundaries, and we only calculate the stress field here on the computational grid, but in principle the fold has infinite size.
So if you were to reload the same configuration, it would again develop those cells, or the cells are sort of put in by hand, the patches on the fold?
So this is not made by hand. This is the situation after a certain time of model evolution.
The question is how the residual stresses appear. And I would have thought that after this thing goes for a while, it has to be stopped somewhere, and that's going to leave residual stresses in the system, and that's what's going to determine the effect of what's going to happen in the next earthquake. How does that show up in this model?
This is the movie that we had shown.
Yeah.
Just before the rupture started, you saw the residual stress.
Yeah, but how does the rupture itself then create new residual stress? See, it feels to me as if he's just unloaded everything.
In this particular case that he showed, there was a system size event that sort of propagated from one end to the other. So it does produce large stress smoothing. There are lots of small events as well here. So if you look at the evolution,
okay.
Yeah.
There's constant transfer of stress internally.
But is it fair to say that it's basically a non-inertial model, so you don't see the same kind of overshoots?
It is a non-inertial model. But there is actually a feature here, which approximates inertia, and that is there is a slight overshoot of the block. The stress block actually is by 25% or so, 20% larger than the difference between the static and kinetic friction. So that's an approximation.
Okay, maybe I'm jumping ahead, but I thought what the idea was that you would be calculating a whole series of earthquakes.
Yes.
And that each one then has to be, even the great big ones, have to leave some sort of trace.
That's correct.
So to
make it clear, this here was one earthquake, one system size earthquake, and after the earthquake is terminated, the interseismic processes, tectonic loading and aseismic creep, set in again, and then we have again this process of pattern formation, and we have in between some two system size events, we have a couple of small and intermediate size events occurring. And then after some time, we have the next system size event. So what we have seen here in this movie is in principle the intra event time scale. And yeah.
If you could just hopefully answer one more question, or last question maybe. What is happening? The rupture front is quite obvious, but what is happening behind the rupture front? Does a point only slide once instantaneously, or is it?
No.
I didn't see any evidence that the stress was rising and falling in that simulation.
Yeah.
So it fails multiple times.
Yes, it can fail multiple times.
But in this simulation, what's it doing? Is it kind of a little narrow band, or is it?
In this particular simulation, did it? I guess it did.
But there are other model realizations where you can see it more clearly, where you have an oscillation.
So that was the confusing part.
The color scheme is such that unfortunately you only see in this color scheme the large scale features. Don't you see?
Why doesn't it just go to dynamic friction? I mean, if you've got constant dynamic friction, why doesn't it go to constant dynamic friction everywhere?
I'm not sure if I understand it, but if a cell has failed, then the strength drops to the dynamic friction,
right.
And then it may slip again if this dynamic threshold is exceeded by.
Right. But finally, everything will be only at the dynamic friction, so it's constant stress. It has to be at the dynamic friction stress at the spot, and then it cannot go up anymore, or else it slides again. So the whole field could be essentially at the dynamic friction stress.
Yes, that's true.
Constant stress.
Not exactly.
You can't have it both ways.
I think that this group of us should let him. And then we shut up for a little while.
But let me only say one point concerning this question of multiple slips. One point is, of course, the color scale, that you don't see it here very good here with this color scale. The other point is this particular model simulation where you have a smooth fault with a relative regular rupture. There are other realizations with rough folds, and you see patterns of almost oscillatory behavior. And there you see very clearly this multiple slips, but this occurs. And yeah. Okay, I go on. So this model produces here two types of data. The first one are earthquake catalogs on the inter-event time scale. And catalogs consist of earthquake time, earthquake hypocenter, this was the green dot here, and the earthquake size, which can be measured in terms of the moment or the magnitude or simply the rupture area, which is the number of cells which failed during the simulation. And the second type of data, which is not so relevant for this talk here, and it's also more work in progress or future work, we can consider rupture histories on the intra-event time scale and study the slip or the stress as a function of space and time during a single earthquake. Yes, in general, yes. The stress drop is these thresholds or the stress drop are space dependent. So, okay. So now I understand the question. Okay, this is space dependent. Yeah, this will be the next point. So this is we have. It is necessary that we have a certain degree of disorder in all simulations, else we get, in principle, periodic sequences of earthquakes and a very simple catalog. And therefore, we need always a certain degree of heterogeneity on the fold. And the next point will be a more systematic study of heterogeneity on the fold. And the study of the influence of these heterogeneities. And I want to show here two end member cases for the heterogeneity or for heterogeneities on the fold, which are included here in terms of stress drop. So we use here high stress drop barriers in an environment of low stress drops, which is here shown in this on these figures here. This is the fold plane and the z-axis is the stress drop, and this type of heterogeneities have been introduced originally by Yehuda in order to simulate fold segmentation in terms of step over regions and fold offsets. And for the simulations, it's important that we get here along this heterogeneities or along the barriers very strong fluctuations of the stress field. And we can tune the degree of disorder by means of including a different number of barriers here on the fold, a small number of barriers and a high number of barriers. And we can we study at first the most common feature of earthquake catalogs, the frequency size distribution, and we see that for this relatively smooth fold with a small number of barriers, we get here the red curve, which is a characteristic earthquake distribution, whereas for the relatively rough fold, we get a distribution here, which is a green one, and which is more similar to Gutenberg-Richter law with a broader scaling range. And in principle, this is not surprising because the important underlying quantity of the fold is the number of the range of size scales where the rupture can evolve between the barriers. For example, we have here only two such size scales, and these small number of size scales produce here this characteristic earthquake bump, whereas in the case of the rough fold, we have a higher number of such size scales, and this is reflected in the frequency size distribution as a broader scaling range here, leading to a Gutenberg-Richter law.
Exponent?
Sorry?
You get the Gutenberg-Richter exponent, right?
Yes, this is around 1, between 0.8 and 1.2, depending on the simulation, but in this interval. The next point, which is intuitively also clear, is that smooth folds produce overall smooth stress fields, and rough folds produce overall rough stress fields. So this is the stress field which we have seen in the movie here. So to some extent, we can use here the frequency size distribution as a proxy for the degree of roughness on the fold. So it's of course a simplification, because there are other factors which can have influence on the frequency size distribution. But in this view, we can say that, for example, a characteristic earthquake distribution somehow points to a smooth fold and also to a smooth stress field.
If you took this seriously and you looked at Park Field as your characteristic earthquake, you would forecast that you would have 10 magnitude 4s for every magnitude, every characteristic earthquake at Park Field. I don't think that's the same. I mean, I don't argue with what you got, but it seems to me that the stuff on the left is much lower for characteristic earthquakes than what you have.
Yeah, so, yeah, I wouldn't claim that this is really, in this particular stage, that this is really a suitable model for Park Field.
Does the time delay make a difference in your distribution? If you did an infinite shear wave velocity, if everything else the same, would you get the same results?
For the for the frequency size distribution, it makes no significant difference to the quasi-static model.
So do your smaller events sit near the barriers or anything like that? Do you have any kind of clustering that in the neighborhood for the smaller events of the barriers? Are they evenly distributed in your smooth regions? Or, you know what I'm saying? There's spatial, some of these kinds of models, you'll have big stress heterogeneities at the perimeters where events have stopped in the past, and then next time around you have a lot of earthquakes near those boundary regions. And I'm just wondering what you see in this model.
So in this version of the model, we have many events along the barriers, and we have also so in this we have many events along the barriers, and also many events in depths, which is not very realistic, but there are ways to overcome this. So in this present stage of the model, the hypocenter distribution is not very realistic, but this can be modified by using, for example, creep, this creep mechanism with the depth dependence, or introduce depth dependent creep rates, which can lead, or which lead then to a more realistic hypocenter distribution. But this is really the simplest version of the model, and all this questions of hypocenter clustering and hypocenter distribution, some of them will be discussed here in the talk. Okay, so the next question is the occurrence, this has to somehow to do with this question, but for the main shocks, this is the question whether main shocks occur regular or irregular, again for these end member cases. Sorry, I have to use. Yeah, okay, we look again at this smooth fold here, and this is simply a sequence of main shocks, earthquakes with magnitude greater than or equal to 5.7. And it's a simulation over 1,000 years, and we see, of course, this is not an absolutely regular behavior of main shocks, but we see at least periods or intervals which look somehow similar to those of Park Field, where we have regular occurrence of main shocks over a certain interval followed by a gap. So what we see, yeah?
The spikes actually proportional to the magnitudes of the vane shots?
The spikes?
The question is, do I take seriously the fact that they're all exactly the same?
No, it's as in the slide before, the y-axis has again no meaning. This means only that we have earthquakes with magnitudes greater than or equal to 5.7, but I do not make a difference because I wanted to make clear that this is a sequence of such main shocks, and I didn't want to confuse you by different heats of the peaks. So this here can be 5.7, but it can also be 7.0 or 7.1. Okay, I only wanted to show the temporal sequence here of main shocks, and this threshold is of course somehow arbitrary.
But I said talk yesterday, it would be clearly desirable to have a histogram of this.
Yeah, I agree, and I will calculate the...
You could have done it last night.
Okay, but I promise you, I calculate the distribution of recurrence times. to take the second end member case of the rough fold, we see that the main shocks occur in a more disordered way here, and in this particular sequence, it's not so easy, or it's in principle not possible to find a regular interval like in the top figure here. So this is the second important point. The degree of disorder or the degree of heterogeneity have not only influence on the statistical properties but also on the temporal occurrence of seismicity. So the next point is the question of aftershocks. We know that aftershocks are probably the most dominant pattern in empirical earthquake catalogs, and I've shown here a figure of the Landers aftershock sequence from 1992, where we see that we have a strongly clustered aftershock sequence after the Landers main shock. And if we prepare a similar situation in the model, then we see that we have not only no aftershocks, so here we have aftershocks, and here we have not only no aftershocks, but we have absolute quiescence after the main shock, which is of course highly unrealistic, although we can understand it in terms of our model. If we go back to this, yeah? This is the smooth simulation, but in the case of the rough simulation, it will be at least similar. In the case of the rough simulation, we would have some events here. But this here is a smooth simulation. And if we go back to this movie, which I showed you, you have seen that the fold was almost unloaded after the main shock. And this is the reason that we have not enough stress immediately after the main shock to trigger aftershocks, and therefore we have in principle absolute quiescence until the stress level has recovered to a moderate value and the next earthquakes can occur, and this leads here to this gap. This is a drawback of this of the present version of the model, which has to be overcome. And one possibility to generate aftershocks or to overcome this problem of quiescence after the main shock is to go back to this idea of barriers, which go from the surface to depths. And we go one step further and make these barriers completely aseismic. So we have here two types of computational cells. We have seismic patches and we have aseismic barriers in between. I want to point out that I do not claim that this is realistic or this is the reality, but it's somehow a suggestion of how we can generate aftershocks in the model. So what happens if we use this type of model and if we run simulations with this mixture here of seismic and aseismic?
What are you thinking of, though, with the creeping barriers? I'm wondering what you're thinking of.
So the creeping barriers, as mentioned before, could be a very simplified way to model fold segmentation, so that we have different fold segments which are interrupted or which have offsets where we have, for example, viscoelastic material. So in general, our model is, or this model of a planar fold is of course not realistic because folds are not strictly planar, but what we have in mind that we have a fold system which looks like this. And this is in our model simply mapped on a planar fold. And if we map here these offsets on the computational grid, we get here the barriers. And if we assume that we have some kind of viscoelastic material, for example, in between, then we come to a fold like this. But this is of course a very simplified and conceptual way of generating aftershocks. I don't want to claim again that this is a reality.
So the stresses propagate through these barriers, but
so we have this may become clear on the next slide. We have here the creeping barriers which undergo the tectonic loading and the creep deformation, and we have the seismic the seismic patches in between, which have additionally the ability to undergo brittle failure. And the important point is that the creeping mechanism is a coupled mechanism where the cells are coupled, so these barriers can transfer stress although they cannot break themselves. And this is in principle the feature which which leads to the aftershocks, as I show here. If we run a simulation for a main shock and the time after the main shock with this model here, we get here a main shock with 6.6 or so magnitude, and we get, as desired, an aftershock sequence. And why does this occur now? If we look at the mean stress in the brittle regions, so these patches, and in the creep regions, these barriers, then we see, as expected, in the brittle regions, we have a stress drop when the main shock occurs, and then the stress will be stored in the barriers, and after the main shock, we have a relaxation process of stress release from the barriers into the rest of the fold. And this additional stress, which is here redistributed in this relaxation process, leads to the generation of aftershocks. And in this model here, to come back to the question which we had some slides ago, in this version of the model, most of the aftershocks will occur at the boundaries of the fold segments here, because the stress is stored during the main shock in the barriers and then released from the barriers to the rest of the fold. Which one? No, this is a model simulation. Yeah. So what I do by hand, or what I introduce, is this distribution of barriers here onto the fold, and I say that this computational cell is a so-called creep cell, and it's unable to. Yes, this is what this is the modification of the model. Yeah. So if we have a main shock which starts here, then we have a redistribution of stress from the main shock. The cell, the creep cell, stores the stress because it cannot because it cannot slip. And after the main shock, the creep mechanism is responsible for the redistribution from the creep barriers to the rest of the fold. And This is in principle the process, or the fact that we have here a coupled process is responsible for the generation of aftershocks.
Does the main shock jump the barriers?
Yes, the main shock can jump the barriers because, as I said, the barrier cannot break itself or cannot slip itself, but stress can be transferred through the barriers.
What is this due to the
Gutenberg-Richter
distribution?
It
you essentially converted the model to a one-dimensional model.
One-dimensional?
Well, what is that you have this sort of one-dimensional or sequence of regions which communicate with each other. Back also then I would have been happier if these regions were more complicated and left sort of connected and percolating patches of seismic reactive stuff.
Okay, for the question of aftershock generation, it is in principle or it is not necessary that we have this shape here. We could also introduce patches, or we could introduce disconnected regions or disconnected creep regions. So the fact that we used here barriers in order to simulate something like this, but this is not essential for the question of aftershocks.
But the point is that when you make this array of these barriers, you must also be doing some damage to the statistics of the main shocks as they're going to be damped out too, leaving lots of energy in the barriers. And so the question is, how much damage do you do? Or is it damage, or does it make it more realistic?
It looks more realistic.
I wouldn't be surprised.
It makes it more realistic because the sequences also become more realistic and also the statistic becomes more. But it definitely doesn't destroy the statistics. So
it seems like though your longest patch, right, horizontally, is not as deep here as your fault. So you've chopped it up in such a way that there are lots of these little creep barriers as opposed to any long regions and short regions. How did you choose the length distributions on the horizontal axis between your creeps?
This.
Because I would have thought that you would have had some long.
So this is just one realization.
Right. No,
this is one realization, and this is
vertical in predominantly vertical in length as opposed to horizontal, which is what I think of.
Yeah.
For the standard.
But so he has an algorithm which what happens is you can walk on the surface of the you can walk, and at some probability you pick initiators of those barriers. Once you pick an initiator, start going down to depths with a 1D angle walk. So you get these slightly not perfectly straight barriers, and as it changes the probability of picking initiators, you can get many or just a few. There are many, many cases in which actually this probability changes.
Okay, I continue. To be a little bit more quantitative, we look at the Omori law, or the question whether the Omori law is fulfilled or not. And here I have stacked a large number of sequences together from a simulation over 5,000 years, including 200,000 earthquakes. And I got the following figure here. This is the rate of earthquakes after the main shock in this stacked representation. And we see that it is in rather good approximation a power law, And in this representation here, we have an Omori exponent of p equal to 1. This is, of course, not an, a universal outcome, but it depends on the distribution of creep velocities or on the average creep velocity, because if we have a very high creep velocity, then we have a very quick relaxation of stress after the main shock, and if it's very low, the creep velocity, then the aftershocks are almost invisible because they are distributed over the entire seismic cycle. So here we have some kind of intermediate creep velocity or intermediate average creep velocity leading to p equal to 1 for the Omori exponent. And the second figure here shows the number of aftershocks as a function of the earthquake size here in terms of the rupture area. And you see this is also reasonable that larger earthquakes trigger more aftershocks.
You're using linear viscosity in your frequency sections?
No, not linear. This is a power law of viscosity, a power law behavior.
What power?
The creep velocity, power creep of
t. It's a power law creep law, but the creep coefficient is constant.
Yeah, okay, this is here the creep coefficient, which depends on the position.
But it's a cubic law.
And this is constant in time.
Change the cubic? Do you think you've changed the power here?
Yes, I think so. I would expect that yes, I would expect this. Because it, yeah. Yeah, I think so, that this also modifies the Omori, or the length of the interval, and also the decay properties of the Omori law. Yes, I would expect this.
It breaks in the real world when active faults, so they're more or less the same. I mean, can we understand from this that maybe the power of one or something, the Omori law, as a consequence of the fact that all the plates were more or less moving at the same rate, or by accident they came out to be plus or one plus or minus something?
The creep rates. The message is in principle, so we have here two types of creep rates. So the creep rates in this viscoelastic material, which has a very high creep, and outside we have a very low creep. And in principle, the key quantity is the ratio of this of these creep rates. So the ratio of creep between in the barriers and outside. So this is here the key quantity, and not the absolute creep rates here.
They both have the same values of p. Power law. They're all cubic.
Yes. The creep law is the same. Only the creep rates are different or are space dependent.
I mean, the reason to pick three is that it's dislocation creep. I mean, that's sort of a standard wisdom.
Right?
Yeah.
Look at this ratio, back to my question. Okay, look at this ratio in the Earth. This ratio more or less the same. Is it set, or are there large divergences?
The Earth is exponentially temperature dependent.
on the Earth, it's temperature and pressure dependent, and therefore it's depth dependent. So it's somehow in terms of this model here, the distribution of all the values of the creep rates are somehow chosen in such a way that we get this Omori law, and this is not motivated by real observations. So this is somehow the answer to the question. So and I as I said before, I do not claim that this is everything or that this is here really the reality that we have here, this creeping barriers with certain creep values, but this is somehow a suggestion for a mechanism which can be which can serve as a mechanism for the generation of aftershocks. And this is in this sense it's modeling on a conceptual level.
Can you describe what you mean in the stacked sequence here? What's a main shock? Is there some threshold that you chose for what's a main shock and what's
yes.
not a main shock?
In this simulation, I took a threshold of magnitude 6 for a main shock. And the maximum magnitude in this simulation was about 6.6, 6.7. This is a model realization with these barriers, and in between, the fault is relatively smooth. So it produces also a characteristic earthquake distribution with relatively high number of main shocks.
Now, if you were to, the smaller earthquakes have their own aftershocks in this model. I think that's what the lower plot shows.
Yeah.
Mm. If you were to plot for the small earthquakes, their aftershock sequences, would they have a similar characteristic time of 2 or 3 years, I see here, for example?
No. The time, so I have not a plot for this, but the time for the small earthquakes is smaller. So it's significantly smaller.
Why do you have more that have a higher rupture area?
Sorry?
What's this rupture area? Is that the rupture area of each aftershock or the main shock?
The main shock rupture area. Mm. So I could have also taken a magnitude of the main shock or something else or a moment. But this only confirms that larger main shocks produce also more aftershocks as is expected and observed.
If that's law, that's law?
Yes, I have. I haven't studied this systematically, but I have chosen or I have looked at several cases, and I've seen that the largest aftershock is about 1 to 1.2 magnitudes smaller than the main shock. So I get approximately, for the cases I have studied, I got approximately Barth's law. But I do not want to claim that this is, it's encouraging, yeah. Okay, I agree. Mm. Okay, aftershocks are relatively strongly pronounced here in this model. It is interesting that we also see a slight increase of activity before a main shock, and this is only visible if we really stack many sequences together. This is not visible in single sequences, and we see here a slight increase, but the tendency is relatively clear, increase of activity before the main shock in this stacked plot here. And so this is somehow in agreement with observations, because foreshocks are a relatively rare phenomenon and not as pronounced as aftershocks. And if we now look at the frequency size distributions of the foreshocks compared to the overall frequency size distribution, we get the following situation. This is now a cumulative frequency size distribution. And we see that the blue one for the whole catalog is characteristic earthquake law, whereas the red one here is the distribution for only for the foreshocks, which is of course less smooth because we have a smaller number of foreshocks. But we can see at least the tendency that the in the red curve, this characteristic earthquake bump, or in this representation, the plateau, is more or less suppressed. And this looks a little bit more similar like the Gutenberg-Richter distribution. And this can be explained in terms of the critical point concept for earthquakes, or what we call critical point concept for earthquakes, because we have in the beginning, if we go back to this relationship between the frequency size distribution and degree of disorder, we have immediately after a main shock, we have a relatively smooth stress field, which begins to roughen until the next earthquake occurs. And immediately before the next main shock occurs, we have a very rough stress field, which is characterized by a high degree of disorder. And this is exactly reflected here in the frequency size distribution, which looks more similar to the Gutenberg-Richter law, although the entire simulation is more characteristic earthquake law. And this, in our interpretation, this is somehow an indication, this roughening of the stress field, for the approach towards the critical point here.
But this goes back, this is backwards to AMR. An accelerated moment release would tend to keep the Gutenberg vector small and then bend upwards before the earthquake.
So AMR, so AMR is first, it's a long-term process over years and decades. I will show some figures on AMR later on the next slides. And these are foreshocks. This is a seismicity 1 month before the earthquake. And this is...
But if this really happened, you could forecast earthquakes.
In principle, If this would be strictly valid, and if we have a reasonable, if we would have a reasonable frequency size statistics, we could say this gradual change from the frequency size distribution would be a precursor to a main shock. In principle, yes, but this here is a frequency size distribution of 200,000 events, and we don't have such a database for real folds. So, in principle, if you take the model very serious and say this is the reality, then in principle yes, but in practice no.
Yeah.
Why
don't you compare the red line with the blue line, but only samples with the equal number of earthquakes? This
here
you have many more events, as you say.
Okay.
If you do a random sampling of okay, this, and then
you see
really
is a different phenomenon. Okay, I agree. This is one way to make the curves more comparable, and then we could also apply statistical tests to make this or to analyze the significance of this of the difference. I agree. Yes, that's true. So So some words about accelerating moment release, which is probably known here. This is a figure from Buffe and Barnes for the Loma Prieta earthquake. They found that the Benioff strain, which is the sum over square root of energy, accelerates like Tc minus T to the power m before the main shock. In our model, this is not easy. As in the case of the foreshocks, it's not easy to analyze this because we have, in a stacked representation, we have to stack different seismic cycles with different lengths, so this is not straightforward. And therefore, we use a simple normalization. We see that the stress here on the fold increases linearly until the main shock occurs. Then we have this relaxation process, and then again a linear increase. So over a large fraction of the seismic cycle, we have a linear increase of stress as a function of time. This is a corresponding earthquake rate here. And here we have plotted potency as a function of the normalized stress level. And we see that this is in, some approximation of power law. And if we have in mind that the stress here increases in principle over most of this, over a large fraction of the seismic cycle linearly with the time, then we can in principle replace here the stress axis by the time axis, and we get a potency release according to a power law, or as a power law for the, or we get potency, that the potency is a power law as a function of the time. And then we have to transform the potency into cumulative Benioff strain, and we get the following result here. The model produces here a value of the exponent, which is 0.25, and this is somehow in good agreement with Buffe and Barnes, who found 0.3 for Loma Prieta. Then we have a systematic study of Bowman et al. For California seismicity for 8 or 9 earthquakes in California, where m is between 0.18 and 0.55. And we have also theoretical works on this problem. For example, Rundle et al. Used a spinoidal model, and they found 0.25 as in our model. And finally, Bentzain and Liakovsky found an analytical expression in their damage rheology model of 0.3. So this is in quite good agreement with these observational and theoretical results that we get here, accelerating moment release with this particular exponent. And so from this point of view, we get also support for this critical point concept in terms of accelerating moment release. And we have also some support from older works on the growth of the spatial correlation lengths. I think I skip this now. This is additional support for the critical point concept, but I think in the interest of time, I don't go into the detail and come to the summary now. So we have a model which produces realistic frequency size distributions, which produces to some degree also realistic clustering properties. And we have seen that long simulations are very important because they unveil more characteristics of seismicity catalogs than only single sequences. We have seen that that we get foreshocks and accelerating moment release if we stack many sequences together, and this is in general not visible in single sequences or only in a few single sequences. We have found some support for the critical earthquake concept, and we have found that spatial heterogeneities seem to play an important role for earthquake statistics, also for the temporal occurrence of main shocks, and which I have not shown here, also for rupture dynamics. Thank you. Thank you for your patience.
You are using the green instruction for an homogeneous elastic medium, for the, yeah. And you are saying the special heterogeneity by bottom. So, is it important that you are using this specific green structure, or could you use any kind of medium running interaction that's maybe with disorder? Do you think it would change anything?
So I use this Green's function because it's simply some kind of generic case. And if something changes, if I use, for example, nearest neighbor interaction or a more complicated Green's function.
Simpler
Green's function like nearest neighbor or mean field. It depends on the Green's function. We had yesterday a discussion on mean field Green's function. This changes, of course, very much because events become unstoppable if a certain patch has ruptured. And I would say that if I take, for example, nearest neighbor Green's function, like in many cellular automaton representations, I would guess it changes not very much because nearest neighbor is simply such a Green's function, whereas our Green's function, here is R and here is, in principle, she. We have here 1 over R cube and which is concentrated around this, around zero, and nearest neighbor is something like this. So I think this changes not very much, but this is only a guess, and it depends on the Green's function. But I think for this case, I would say the elastic half-space Green's function is the most appropriate choice for a Green's function.
How you had potency up there? How do you define that?
Potency is the integral of the total slip over the area. In principle, it's the slip integrated over the area.
But you argue that's related to Benioff strain.
Yeah, from the potency you can calculate the moment. Moment is rigidity times potency or rigidity divided.
Rigidity times potency.
It's rigidity times potency, and from the moment we can calculate Benioff strain or magnitude energy Benioff strain.
And the power of all of the two are the same?
The power?
Yes. You're getting power law potency comparing it to the experiments on Benioff strain.
Yes.
The same power law?
Not the same power law, but you can calculate the power law, or you can calculate the exponent for the Benioff strain from the exponent from the potency. So I don't know what the exponent here in this figure was, but.
How big was your system, and do you have any reason to expect or not expect that the size of the system would change the result? Are there system size effects?
The system is the fold is in this representation 70 kilometers times 70.5 kilometers, and it has 32 cells along depth and 128 cells along strike. And of course, the size of the system has some influence on results. And
I mean, if you halved your mesh size.
Yeah.
Okay, so you have four times as many cells. Would you get exactly the same result or not? I mean, that's the question. Does it make, how does the fact that you discretized the system at this level affect your result? I mean, you get a completely different result if you measured it differently. Or if you used a triangular mesh instead of a square mesh.
Okay, if we take more cells, then we get a different system. We get a different. We can, for example, calculate as smaller earthquakes. Here, the minimum number of the minimum magnitude is around 4, which is given by the size of the cell. If we take smaller cells, then we get smaller magnitudes, and this is of course a different system.
No, it's the same system. It's a different model, right? We're trying to model a system
yeah.
that has.
If I say it's the same, it's a different system. I mean, it's a different model.
Yeah.
Let me pose the question another way. One of the things that we do in statistical physics all the time is finite size scaling in order to see whether the exponents that we're determining are somehow related to crossover effects at the two ends, or whether they're intrinsic. And by doing scaling with doubling the system size or doubling the resolution, usually doubling the system size and keeping the small scale the same, and seeing whether the slopes change or not, that's one of the ways you figure out whether you're seeing a robust Gutenberg-Richter type exponent or whether you just happen to be lucky to be in the right, have the right size. I'm not suggesting you're in the limit,
cool.
I'm just saying, but the question is, have you ever thought about trying to perform that kind of consistency check?
Yes, I have used a system with a double, number of cells, and the results were in principle the same, or most of the results stayed relatively stable.
So this,
at least the frequency size distribution. So you mean if, for example, the characteristic earthquake may be a finite size effect, and this is not the case. This is also on for other fault sizes valid.
And maybe you can add to that. You can also, if you do the mean, if you calculate mean for statistics, that should on long length scales be the same as the one more acute that he has. So his simulations are in the range of 6 months. So that's another. So you get the same behavior. Yeah, the same statistics. I mean, for the size.
Perhaps you mentioned at the beginning, I missed it if you did, how did you handle the boundaries of the model? But what happens to slip at the boundaries of the model? And what kind of, is it periodic?
No, it's open boundaries, You mean the boundary conditions for the computational grid? Yeah, it's the boundaries for the computational grid are open. So in principle, we consider a fold of infinite size, and we have a certain computational grid where we calculate stress and slip, and the slip and the stress runs over the boundaries, and then for our simulation, it's lost, but it's of course somehow conserved because fold has, in principle, infinite size.
So the, I'm not quite sure I understand, but the cells on the boundary then are infinite length. So slip, when slip enters them, it just goes. Is that how that's
so
translated?
You mean the slip, outside the computational grid?
Right. Yeah. The slip pile up at the ends, or do you let it?
So the slip.
In many cases, that kind of affects the results too. Of course, it's how you handle the boundaries.
So the slip outside the computational grid is, in principle, could be calculated in a similar way as inside the grid, but it is not calculated because we only calculate earthquakes on this grid. But it goes over the boundaries as on the computational grid itself.
Okay.